superheroes. I don't know where we would be without the intellectual ammunition that John Lott has been providing us for oh so long. He joins us right now, talking about...
Well, I appreciate being here. I want to thank Julianne for organizing this and putting things together as she has each year. So, oh, sorry about that. Okay. So I kind of want to talk a little bit about the current debate that's going on and tell you how I would kind of deal with the debate. So take something like universal background checks. I mean, obviously, it's something that gets pushed after each mass public shooting. If you go back and look at when Obama was president, whenever we had a mass public shooting, it was usually the only law that he would go and try to push. The irony, obviously, is there's not one mass public shooting this century that would have been stopped by having that in effect. And I'm pretty skeptical that universal background checks, and I can talk about it a little bit, would have any impact on crime rates. But people want to do something. I want to do something. If I want to do something, I'd try to do something like get rid of gun-free zones. But people who have been to these conferences in the past have heard me talk about it a lot. So if you're going to have universal background checks, and I have nothing in principle problem with it, I just don't think it's going to do any good, at least not have it do harm. And there's a few things which I consider very reasonable. I mean, one of the big phrases that's often used by gun control advocates is they want reasonable gun control laws. Well, let me advocate what I think are a few reasonable fixes for universal background checks, so I don't think they'll do harm. So one of the issues is costs. If you live in Washington, D.C., it costs $125 to go and do the universal background check to privately transfer a gun. You live in New York City, it costs at least that much. There are places which will charge even more. You go across the country, places like Oregon, you can find it for $55, what have you. But this is a real cost of going and doing it. It may not stop you or I from being able to get a gun, but my concern is that the people who benefit the most from owning guns, poor minorities, particularly poor blacks, $125 or even $80 may make the difference between whether they're able to obtain a gun legally to defend themselves and their families. But there's a bigger problem with this, and that is, let's say you really believe background checks lower crime. Well, do you really want to tax people for going and doing what you think is good? I mean, that's one thing I never really understand. It seems like you'd want to reward them rather than taxing them. So if you really believe, if gun control advocates really believe that encouraging people to go and do background checks on the private transfers of guns will somehow reduce crime, why are you going to make them pay a $125 fee for doing that? You know, one of the more bizarre things I'll just mention quickly, and that is in Washington, D.C., if you and I lived there and I was going to give you four guns to one person, you think that's just one background check, right? But no, the background checks are on each gun. So rather than charging $125, they charge $500 to transfer, and I think it gets to what the point is. So there's two issues here. One is, if you want to encourage background checks, don't penalize the person for going and doing it. And the second thing is, if you believe background checks reduce crime, you believe it reduces crime for everybody, not just the particularly law-abiding person who's going out of their way to go and do a background check. Well, if you believe that, if everybody benefits, then make everybody pay. Why put the entire burden of this on the law-abiding person who's going out of their way to go and have the background check on the private transfer there? Both of these arguments indicate that you should pay for this out of general revenue rather than putting the whole benefit on the person who you're supposedly wanting to encourage to go and do the background check. There's another issue here, and that's this issue of false positives. And I understand the White House understands this, which is a huge step forward over previous administrations. So you constantly hear this claim that there are 3.5 million dangerous prohibited people that have been stopped from buying guns because of background checks. That's simply false, okay? Calling it a lie isn't too strong. Look, What you should say is that there are 3.5 million initial denials, and virtually all of those are mistakes. I can't tell you the exact number. I can give you a rough estimate. My own guess is it's something around 99% of the people who are stopped are mistakes. So you go and you look at the last annual report that was put out on the NICS system in 2010. The Obama administration stopped putting this out. They had 76,000 initial denials. And then there's five stages of review that occur in the NICS system. The first stage of review, the BATF national office, no discretion, not having any lawyers looking at it, just have regular people going and just checking the paperwork, and about 94% of the cases are dropped at that stage. The second stage of review, it gets sent out to the BATF field offices. Again, no discretion, no lawyers looking at it, making sure the paperwork is right. They add in a little bit about whether it's a recent case, but I found cases that deal with violations that are 45 years old, so I don't know what recent means in this case. And in 2004, Congress did an audit of the Brady Act on its 10th anniversary, and what they found is this second stage of review, there was another 2 percentage points of the cases that were dropped. So for just the first two stages of review, with no discretion, 96% of the cases that are dropped. If you look at the numbers for 2010, 76,000 initial denials, 48 cases were referred for prosecution, 28 cases were prosecuted, and they got 13 convictions. And if you look at the 13 convictions, particularly the ones that deal with things like perjury, so you fill out the form, you're a felon, you somehow forget to mention that on the form, that, you know, these are actually easy convictions to go and get. The fact that there's so few convictions, it really makes you wonder. And there's a simple explanation for this, and that is they're not real cases. You know, the irony is when Clinton was president, Republicans attacked Clinton for not enforcing gun control laws. Exhibit A was all the background checks that were failed and the few number of convictions, exactly the types of numbers I'm going through. When Bush was president, Democrats attacked him for not enforcing the gun control laws. When Obama was president, Republicans, even some favorites of mine like Ted Cruz and whatever, would go and attack Obama for not enforcing the gun control laws. It's not that they're not enforcing the gun control laws. I have some good friends that were in the Bush administration. Reagan Dunn was the first head director of Project Safe Neighborhood. That whole purpose of that group in the Department of Justice was to enforce gun control laws. And Reagan will tell you, he said, look, they'd love to prosecute the cases if they were real cases. But it's one thing to stop a felon from buying a gun. It's another thing to stop somebody simply because they have a similar name to a felon from buying a gun. When you fill out the 4473 forms, you put down your name, your Social Security number, your address, your age, your race, your eye color, your gender. You think they're using all that information. What they'll frequently use is just roughly phonetically similar names and similar birthdays. And the problem is it's particularly minorities that are harmed as a result of this. Hispanics and blacks, people tend to have names similar to others in their racial groups. Hispanics have names similar to other Hispanics. Blacks tend to have names similar to other blacks. 33% of black males are legally prohibited from owning guns because of past criminal history. Of course, there are other reasons why they may be prohibited too, but whose names are their names most likely to be confused with? Other law-abiding good black males who want to get a gun to protect themselves and their families. Here's the deal. Go to a Democrat in Capitol Hill, and because I've done this, and just say, don't talk to them about guns, but just say, you know, I think companies, when they do criminal background checks on employees, ought to just go and look at roughly phonetically similar names. They will have a cow. I mean, they will go nuts on you, and they will say, well, there's absolutely no way you could do that. That's ridiculous. That would cause so many false positives, and it would be racially discriminatory. And you say, you know, you're right on that. Of course, most companies, if you were to tell an employer, you know, maybe you ought to think about doing just roughly phonetically similar names, they're going to look like you're from Mars, because they have no desire to go and create all sorts of false positives for their employees. But why not, as a simple, quote, reasonable fix again, why not simply require that the federal government has to do criminal background checks in the same way that the federal government mandates that private companies have to do it? If it's good enough for the federal government to say you have to go and use the complete information that's there and use it exactly as it's presented to you, why isn't that good enough for the federal government? But look, I've been making these points to gun control advocates for 20 years now. And they will fight you. I'll give you one example. A few years ago when Colorado was passing its background checks on private transfers of guns, I got a call from a few state legislators in Colorado asking me what amendments I would put up on the bill. And one of my suggestions was to put up an amendment that would exempt people below the poverty level from having to pay the new state tax that they have on transferring guns in Colorado. My understanding is the current governor has just increased this to like $75. But so here's the deal. With the exception of two pro-gun Democrats in the state house, every other Democrat in the state house voted against exempting people below the poverty level from having to pay the new state tax. How many taxes can you think of that Democrats will fight tooth and nail against exempting people below the poverty level from having to pay? I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's those types of things, and I could give you multiple other stories that have convinced me over time they really don't care about getting this passed. What they care about are rules that make it costly for law-abiding citizens to be able to go and own guns. There's another issue with regard to background checks that could easily be fixed. So we have two problems that I've mentioned, two easy fixes so far. I think they're both reasonable. I don't even know how you argue against those types of things. So just as an aside before I get into the other two things, my point would be make the Democrats have to be defensive on this. Let them explain why it's okay to have a system that so massively discriminates against minorities. Make them explain why it's okay to make... You can appeal these cases when you have these false positives, but the vast majority of people are going to have to hire a lawyer. It can cost $3,000 plus to go and do that. You're basically discriminating against middle-income and poor minorities overwhelmingly to do that. Make them explain why that's a reasonable system for somebody who no fault of their own is being stopped from being able to go and get a gun to protect themselves and their families. So one of the other big issues is that these universal background checks could be used fairly simply to create a national registry. And it would go something like this. Federally licensed dealers have to keep track of all the transfers and sales that they make under the universal background check system. They already have to do it for sales. Well, 5 years from now, you may have a new president and a new Congress that says, you know all that information you've been collecting and you have to retain? We want you to package it and send it to the federal government. And then you're going to have kind of an instant national registration list for all law-abiding gun owners who have obtained a gun over the previous 5 years that are there. Well, there's a simple fix for this, and that is the same fix, again, that we can look to the federal government for. When the federal government goes and finishes a background check, under federal law, they are required within 24 hours to go and destroy that information. Well, simply have a time limit on how long the FFLs have to go and keep that information. We can debate, but again, I think if you had that fixed, and I think it's a reasonable thing to make there, if they really care about the background check per se, you fix those three things, I have a hard time believing that there'd be much opposition at all. Now, I understand that President Trump has been thinking about having an app-type system where it would be on a cell phone, and the seller would enter the information. You'd have to have a code from a notary republic to kind of keep me from going and finding out that Tom Grisham has 7 felonies from when he was young, you know, just typing in his name and finding that out. So for privacy protection reasons. And so I think it's pretty neat. I'm sure the Democrats will go nuts over something like this for two reasons. One, it would effectively solve the cost issue that's there. And secondly, since all that information would be going through the federal government, and the federal government under current law has to destroy that information within 24 hours, it would effectively mean that you're not creating a national registration list for all those other states that are out there that don't currently require a background check on private transfers. Now, there's one other change to be made. If you read the laws that we have right now in terms of these universal background checks, one of the things they frequently have is that you're only allowed to transfer a gun to somebody temporarily under what's called when they're in quote-unquote imminent danger. And for those who aren't lawyers in the room, imminent danger means they're right there facing the threat. You know, the attacker is like feet away and is threatening them right at that moment. Well, so you have a woman, a friend of yours, who you know knows how to use a gun and you know she has no criminal record, call you up late one evening and she tells you that an ex is threatening her. She's very afraid. The person's made threats and she's asking you if you can borrow your gun for a couple days. And you say, well, is he there right now? And she says, no, but he's maybe going to be here in a few hours. And so if you just lend it to her there right then, you'd be committing a felony under these laws. You could only lend it to her while the attacker's there. And, of course, if you're there lending it to her, you might as well just use the gun yourself. Why? And then as soon as the person leaves, then you'd have to take it back from her in any case. So there's an easy fix for this, too. You could go and have what's called a reasonable person test. Would a reasonable person believe that this woman had legitimate fears for her safety? And that would solve the problem. Anyway, I could go through and talk about these things. I want to talk briefly about red flags. And to me, there are a couple points to make here. But the simplest point is that we already have laws that I think do an even better job of dealing with this issue than red flag laws do. You have something called Baker Acts or 302s, or in California it's 5150. And basically what they allow is somebody can get a 72-hour psychiatric hold that can go and have mental health care experts evaluate the person. If you can't afford a lawyer, a public defender is provided for the individuals at that point. Now compare that to, and there's a whole range of options that judges face. They could go, once they get the reports back and you have the hearing from the mental health care professionals, you could be involuntarily committed. But they could say, look, I'll agree to you voluntarily seeing somebody. We'll come back in a few weeks and we'll evaluate what's happening to see whether something else can happen. Or they could even take away the person's guns. There's a whole range of things that the judges can go and do short of involuntary commitment. How does that compare to red flag laws? Well, red flag laws, despite the impression that's given that they deal with mental illness, the term mental illness is actually only mentioned in one of the state laws that are there. And in fact, none of the states actually require that mental health care professionals actually be involved in the entire process. And with regard to the cost, I mean, you may be talking about $10,000 for a hearing. There's no public defender provided for these individuals. So I may like to keep a gun, right? But is it really worth $10,000 to me to be able to go and keep a gun? A lot of people are going to say it's just not worth it. Why go and challenge this thing? Why go and pay $10,000 for a lawyer to be able to go and keep this? So to me, there's a simple reason why gun control advocates want to have a clean new law called red flags rather than if they have some objection to the existing Baker Act type rules. And that is, it's a lot easier for them to go and start with a new law that doesn't have all the civil protections than it is to go into a law that already exists and pull out those civil protections that are there. I got to 5:30. I got 7 minutes, right? I got to 5:30. Is my clock different than yours? So, okay, I've said 5:30. Anyway, I don't know, maybe it wasn't as interesting as I thought. Ooh, now that's dangerous. He said I could go as long as I wanted. I'm an academic. I can talk forever. That's a dangerous statement to make there. Anyway, so the thing is, there are other problems that can arise with regard to red flags that I don't really think people have thought through completely. So let me give you a story from an extremely good friend of mine. I wish she was actually here to go and say this. I'll say her name because a lot of you may know her. Her name's Nikki Gozer. She had the horrible tragedy of having her husband murdered in front of her by a stalker. And it was in a gun-free zone. That's not relevant for this part of the story. But understandably, having this trauma of having her loved husband murdered right in front of her, she was incredibly depressed afterwards. In fact, I know from talking to her that she was even reticent to go and see mental health care professionals because she was worried that they would take away her ability to go and protect herself there. Well, think about red flag laws. So here you have friends or relatives or neighbors who may be well-meaning, who may say, Nikki's really depressed and she has guns. Maybe we should try to put in a complaint to the judge. All the judge sees when he initially takes away the person's gun is a written complaint in front of them saying, she's depressed, I'm very worried about what she might do, she has guns, maybe we should go and take them away from her. And based on just that written complaint, the judge will go and make his decision. Now, here's the problem. Being able to go and talk to people, even if it's not a mental health care professional, can be extremely helpful for people. You can feel much better after talking to them and maybe knowing that other people have had similar feelings. Well, what does this red flag do to her willingness to go and talk to people? If she's afraid that even a well-meaning person might use this trauma that she's talking to somebody about and explaining this extremely understandable depression that she's going through. Any normal person, you'd be not normal not to be depressed in this situation. That could result in her not being able to protect herself, which was a real fear that she had had. She just had a stalker go and kill her husband there. That now she's afraid to go and talk to people. Now, what damage does that do to somebody? Let me give you another example. So you have a police officer. Police officers tend to be relatively more depressed than the rest of the population. They tend to commit suicide at somewhat higher rates than the rest of the population. Police officers, just like anybody else, probably benefit from being able to talk to friends or relatives or others about how they're feeling. Well, now you may have the same type of situation where they are going to be concerned that if they go and share their feelings with somebody, they could have their gun taken away. Well, what does that do to the police officer's job? They lose their job if they don't have a gun. And so now you're going to have other people who are going to be afraid to go and share their feelings. And so rather than reducing suicides, you may increase them. And of course, this notion that somehow if I really just take away a person's guns, that's going to end the suicide threat. I don't know, maybe they need to talk to Jeffrey Epstein about this. But the notion that somehow the only way that you're going to be able to go and commit suicide is with a gun is just not serious. You have to deal with the underlying problems that are there And having mental health care professionals and others involved seems to me to make a lot more sense. If the person's depressed, simply going and taking away their weapon, or if they may go and cause some type of crime or harm to others. I was briefly involved in the State Uniform Law Commission, which was talking about putting together a model red flag law. I don't think the gun control people on the panel were too thrilled about the way the panel was going, and so they kind of pulled the plug on the whole process. But there are two issues here. One is kind of the mental illness issue with suicides, but the other issue is predicting whether somebody's going to commit a crime. And so we'd bring in people who were in states that were doing this, and I would ask them in my role there, I'd say, okay, how do you predict these things? And there were basically three things that were brought up. You look at past criminal record, you look at age and gender. With regard to criminal record, my comment was, don't we already have laws that if you're a felon, even a nonviolent felon, you're banned for life from being able to own a gun? And they said, yeah, but the point is they want to be able to make it so if you have an arrest but not a conviction, your gun can be taken away. Or if you have a complaint but not even arrest, your gun can be taken away. And my response was, well, why don't we make this explicit? And they said, no, they didn't really want to do that. And I know why they didn't want to do it. I didn't push the point because it was so obvious. The courts have ruled you have a fundamental right to be able to go and defend yourself. They can't take away that right without an adjudication process. And to go and simply have a complaint without an arrest or an arrest without a conviction, they know that if they made that explicit in the law, it would be struck down. So I want to quickly go through the other two things here. Age and gender. I'm listening to these guys, and they say, well, you know, men are more likely to go and commit crimes than women are. Older people are more likely to commit suicide. Young people are more likely to commit crime. And I'm thinking, well, isn't this great? Will someday somebody say blacks are more likely to go and commit crimes than whites, so we should take guns away from blacks? Is that really where we're going on this thing? And so my suggestion, and you can see why maybe the gun control people on the panel didn't think this was going in the right direction, was my suggestion is, well, why don't we have an amendment here that would go and say these laws cannot be used to discriminate on the basis of race, age, or gender, and require that they have to go and collect data on this to see whether they're actually discriminating or not. And it's just kind of fun to watch Democrats go and argue, no, we don't want anti-discrimination provisions in these particular types of laws here. So, anyway, I'm probably over. I'm sure I haven't gone to everything here, but I did want to ask one favor of you guys, and that is we, at the Crime Prevention Research Center, Nikki and I, we put a lot of work together putting out research projects, but it doesn't do a great amount of good for us if you guys don't get them, okay? How many people subscribe to our email list? Okay, how many people, keep your hands up if you think it's a benefit, if you enjoy it. Okay, so at least the other people around here can see this. What I'd appreciate you doing, if you don't mind, is to go to our website at crimeresearch.org, crimeresearch.org, and there's a little tab up in the left, or if you hoover around a page for like 40 seconds, a little pop-up will occur, and just subscribe to it. You can unsubscribe at some future point, but we really try to put out information like what I've been talking about and give you the data so that you can go and argue with people and educate other people about these things. That's the only way we're going to be able to win this discussion here, to try to make people safer. So if you can go to crimeresearch.org and just subscribe to our email list, it would be tremendously appreciated. Thank you very much.